The Los Angeles Rams lost the Super Bowl, and I am really, really happy about that. But we hope you pretend we're football for the next hour. I'm your host, Will Bazer, and I'm joined alongside by Johnny Brashear and Tim Preston, as always. This show is brought to you by Your Ad Here, and also by Hornscast, Hornscast channel on iTunes, Google Play, Podbean, and wherever you guys can find a podcast. Today we're going to be taking stock of the Big 12. Who's going to win it? Who's going to be in last place? Where does Texas finish in it all? And what are the realities with the different players that Texas has right now? We'll get into that after we do our Pretend You're Getting to Know Us this week, which is, y'all, what makes you or made you irrationally angry? Like something that you could rant about for an entire show, but we'll keep it to like 3 or 5 minutes. And again, everybody, feel free to play along with us. But we'll start off with Johnny. Johnny, what made you or makes you irrationally angry?
You know what really grinds my gears?
Oh, he's doing it.
Yeah. So, about a week ago when Texas was playing Kansas, I knew I wasn't going to make it to that game on time. And
I thought you were going to get to the end of the game. And I was like, we already went over that. We already ranted about that for an entire show.
Yeah, no ranting about. That's true. Not that Kansas game, the one in Austin. So I knew I wasn't going to make it home in time for the start of that game due to, you know, what with having a day job, unfortunately. So I've got PlayStation View as my cable, so to speak. I've cut the cord. And they have a DVR on there that is kind of wonky, but it works well enough if you know what you're doing. However, on the PS4, if you look at your DVR with college basketball, it doesn't show me anything past January 19th. And
okay,
the Kansas game was after January 19th. Which means if it's not going on live right then, it's impossible to scroll for and look and find. So I went in and I thought, okay, well, maybe it's just some sort of storage thing, and I'm gonna, like, you know, flush out this cache on my PlayStation account. And I'll, you know, delete the DVR, start it back, and yeah, it'll be fine. And I did that, and it started recording the game. But the problem is it started recording it from the moment I resubscribed. So the first 11 minutes is gone, which is not really how the DVR is supposed to work on this thing. They record everything and give you access to it. So on their side, they have the whole thing. They're just not giving me any goddamn access to it because reasons. And it's
they're holding out on y'all.
Yeah, and it's specific to the PS4. Like any other TV I've got that's got, you know, Fire Stick or whatever, works perfectly fine. It works the way it's supposed to work. And so I get in to the Texas Kansas game with about 9.5 minutes left, and Texas is up like 20-12 or something like that. So I don't understand what happened to get them there. But what I do see is them immediately give up that 8-point lead. And so I went from being grumpy and angry about the DVR to infuriated because now I haven't gotten to watch any of the good part of the game. I'm just getting kicked in the dick.
You're getting the good old Kansas to the dick.
Yeah, I got Kansas to the dick. It's real. Yeah, I got an extra Kansasing. I started. I'm not really a demonstrative angry person. I tend to just sort of ball it all up inside and just kind of keep crushing it inside and until I can drown it in alcohol and it goes away. But this time I started
Johnny,
just,
it never goes away. It just comes out in therapy sessions.
Yeah, I can't afford therapy, not on my copay. It's so this time I just started yelling. And there was nobody in the house, which makes it kind of okay, except for the dog. The dog was in the house. And the dog
he doesn't
got
deserve that shit.
Yeah, he went in the crate. It's yelling loudly enough and angrily enough that he pretty much decided, I don't know if this is about me, but I'm just getting in here. So I have to, like, you know, pack the anger down even further. It's a bigger ball and it's denser and it's harder to but I have to because this goddamn dog now thinks I'm yelling at it, and I'm like, I gotta like swallow it all and just be like, come on out, pup, it's fine. And so I sit there watching Kansas, you know, make a run on Texas, and I'm having to like pet the dog in such a way that's like comforting and not like rubbing his fur off. So that
Johnny,
that was,
why does the dog have blisters?
Yeah, right. Why is the dog coated in Vaseline? I don't want to know the answer to that question. I really don't want to know the answer to that question. So
that could go many ways.
Yes,
too many ways.
Yeah. So yes, that's the angriest I've been about something incredibly dumb in quite a while.
What about you, Tim? What made you incredibly irrationally angry?
All right. So first off, I agree with Johnny. There are very few things in my life that are as grinding as my fucking DVR not working like I'd like for it to, like not being able to get onto a game and I was like, what, like, or somehow I think I'm pressing fast forward and I go live, like, shit, and all of a sudden, yeah, like an hour and 15 minutes into the game. No! Oh, so infuriating.
Do you do the thing I do where you like, when you know you're about to like try and do something, like try and watch the DVR, you like sort of shield that part of the screen from
yes.
your eyes.
Yep. I got to mute it first, right?
Yeah.
Like, so we have Dish Network, so the like the first screen that comes on is like the, you know, like the select screen, so like you can't even like right. turn on the actual apparatus until you've hit select. So I turn it on and then I press mute and then I quickly press select and then DVR immediately so that most of the screen is DVR, and I put my hand up over the top right corner of the screen where there's anyway, so yes, I am totally 100% with you. There are there's very few things in my world that I hate more than knowing the score to a game that I haven't watched. However, another thing that people might be interested in knowing about me, like I am, and maybe this comes out to, regardless, I don't know, I am 100% a creature of habit. I have a very specific amount of things that I like to do. Like when we go on vacation, I like to go to the same place each time because I know I like it. When I drink whiskey and Coke because that's what I do. When I, you know, sit on a couch, I like to sit in the same spot. Like I don't know. I don't feel like I'm super anal retentive, but I kind of have those tendencies. Well,
you're
one
picky.
One of the things in my life that I am so, like, that I feel so snake bit by is that, when I go to a restaurant, I order the same thing every single time because I know I like it and I'm really excited about eating it. And I'm sure there's other stuff that would be fine, but I'm going to eat the same thing each time because that's just what I do. But somehow I have this terrible string of luck that my favorite restaurants or my favorite items at restaurants continue to get discontinued at those places. Right, there was a single Schlotzky's in Iowa. It was in central Des Moines, right by the Capitol building. I went to college not too, you know, or not to college. I had a friend that went to college not too far from there, and so when I would go visit him, we would always eat at Schlotzky's. And then it like as I was there, it closed. And we moved to this new house in Cedar Rapids. And all of a sudden, we were like right down the street from this great deli that had amazing sandwiches and awesome soups. Like, oh, I get to have a really great soup and sandwich place. Let's go. And we moved here in March. It closed in May.
Sorry, it's so on brand for Tim to be like, a really great soup and sandwich place. Let's go.
Yeah, 100%. Yes. Or like when I was in high school, there was a place called Boston Market. Have you guys eaten at Boston Market before? It's just like a chain restaurant.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. There's like 3,000 of them around the country.
Iowa, bitch. Not in Iowa. Everyone in Iowa closed over like a 2 week period. Like, what? They're all gone. And then Wendy's had this thing called the Chicken Caesar Pita. Delicious. Delicious. They stopped making it. Whatever I like best. Like, I'm waiting for Olive Garden to stop serving their spaghetti and meatballs because that's what I like best. And they're like, you know, fuck it. There's no longer cost effective for us to have this on the menu. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do?
We don't believe in pasta.
it just like everything. Like, I have to be careful because if I like something too much, like, it's going to get taken away. Like, I guess I can't like Buffalo Wild Wings hot barbecue boneless wings anymore.
What you need to do is you need to start using that for more nefarious purposes. Like, if you don't like Burger King, be like, you know what I fucking love? Burger King.
Well, we like, and I know you. I know that you guys are. It's all in good fun, right? But like, we don't have Whataburgers up here. Like, we don't have like really a bunch of decent burger places, right? We don't have any number.
Which is weird because you're where all the cows are.
We're about 300 miles from where all the cows are. But yes, I know.
Yeah, but
what
that's
you mean.
All still Iowa, really.
Anyways, so like.
Bingo.
Yeah, right. You win,
around,
you always do.
Around.
So, yes, I can talk about, obviously, I can talk about all of my favorite food options that apparently no one else likes, and either the restaurants close or they get taken off the menu, and that just gets really sad.
Damn, you know what that is?
Frustrating?
Frustrating. Pretty frustrating.
So frustrating.
Uh-huh. So, what else is frustrating, at least to me, is what happened last Sunday for the Super Bowl. The Super Bowl in 2019 against the Rams and the Patriots. And no, this isn't an anti-Ram rant like I started the show off. This is just a regular anti-NFL rant. So for those who follow me on anywhere, they'll know my ire for the NFL post-2016. When the NFL stabbed the city of St. Louis in the heart and me along with it. But it's not just that. It's the halftime show of the last Super Bowl. And here's the problem. The Super Bowl right now is in need of just whatever positive propaganda they can throw out there. Anything. And because they have the CTE issues, they have the Kaepernick issues, they have so many different types of issues that were all kind of brought up around the Super Bowl and kind of brought up whenever you talk about the NFL. There's easy ways to create good propaganda and things that will go viral online. How do you do that? By listening to people who are actually online. Sort of like the Change.org petition to have Sweet Victory performed at the Super Bowl. And if y'all don't know what Sweet Victory is because you're older than I am or younger than I am, here's what we grew up with, people who are around my age. We grew up with SpongeBob. We talk about SpongeBob a lot. We reminisce in the good old days. And with the creator of SpongeBob, Stephen Hillenburg, dying, you know, our generation of children kind of wanted to show you know, our love for SpongeBob and also have one of the best songs, one of the best power ballads out there, Sweet Victory, play the halftime of the show. Because it's featured in the show where SpongeBob and his friends perform that song at the halftime of the Bubble Bowl, or whatever, the Super Bowl of the Bikini Bottom world. 1,500,000 people signed the petition to have SpongeBob performed at the halftime show. And keyword being performed. Maroon 5 picked it up. The NFL picked it up. Everybody was teasing it. They had the voice actor for Squidward. I don't remember what he did. I think he introduced or something. And they had all this hype leading up to this. And everybody is super excited. Oh my God, they're going to play Sweet Victory at halftime. It's going to be awesome. What do? They play 3 seconds of Sweet Victory. 3 seconds, and not even the song, just the intro to the song, which was a bunch of horns. Just a little snippet of it.
It's like our intro.
Was absolutely bullshit. That was the biggest blue balls I have ever, it's ever happened. It was so bad. It was such an easy thing to do, to play maybe even half of a 2-minute song. That's all you have to do. Of the whatever 10-minute halftime show, you use 1 minute for the SpongeBob, it will go instantly viral all over Twitter. It will go viral. It will go crazy. People will go insane. But what does the NFL do? No, they put out fucking sicko mode. Who the fuck cares about that shit? I mean, I know people do. But like, if the NFL wants good press and they wanted people to like stop talking about the shit they've done, that was an easy way to fix it. The Maroon 5. Maroon 5 is getting a bunch of shit for not joining the whatever, the Kaepernick boycott. How could they have easily remedied that? By playing goddamn SpongeBob song for 1 minute in their entire show. That pissed me off because I wanted that and I didn't get it.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I think the ship sailed as soon as they hired Maroon 5, but...
See, but Maroon 5 was more likely to play that song than, like, Travis Scott or Jay-Z or whoever the hell they would have brought on.
I mean, they did have Big Boy for, like, 12 seconds, so there was that.
Right. I'm not the only one who's pissed off. Like, the entire, like, internet, there's an entire subreddit with millions of people in it who are just, like, it's so incredibly angry at the NFL for what they did.
The incels are mad.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's like if they'd in 1998 or 2000, if there had been a chance that they were going to play the Gummy Bear theme song and then they didn't, I probably would have been pretty frustrated too. But all right, so you know the show Knight Rider, of course, right? Knight Rider? Right? So it's a story about it's a show about a guy who...
I do.
Who has a car, and that car can talk.
Yes, and, it can.
Yep, right. So there was also there was one called Street Hawk. And Street Hawk was about...
Motorcycle?
Yep, cop with a motorcycle that could talk. I could watch those two shows, no problem. I could watch those. But then there was also a show called Airwolf, which was about a helicopter that could talk. And that Airwolf one, my parents awesome. Said, you can't watch, it's too dumb. They pulled out the dumb card. Like, okay, I can watch Knight Rider, I can watch Street Hawk, but I can't watch Airwolf. It's horseshit. Yeah. Anyways, I won't let my kids watch SpongeBob. Not gonna happen.
What?
Pulling the stupid card. Wow. There is actual, like, I'm sure
you're
you know this.
Depriving them of greatness.
Yeah,
Jim,
I'm sure
sorry.
That you know this, but there is actual stuff that talks about it makes people dumber.
Speaking of depriving people of greatness. Let's talk about the Texas Longhorns.
Yeah, that's a good idea. So, right now, Texas is halfway through conference play, and let's go ahead and take stock of the Big 12 in general. So, we'll start off with this question right now. In your opinion, taking a look at what's happened so far in the Big 12, who wins the Big 12 at the end of the year, before the conference championship, before that entire tournament? Who
the regular wins? Season title.
Yeah, that one.
Yeah. I'm going to go ahead and say that Kansas and Iowa State tie for first place. That's my pick. I think they both end up at 12-6.
I think Kansas wins.
No tie, wow. Just straight up.
All right.
That was the quickest segment of the show I have ever had. Just one, what is that, three words? I think Kansas wins. That's four words. I think Kansas wins.
We just rocked 18 minutes of pretend you're getting to know us. So,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, I think they win. I think in a league of mediocrity, not mediocrity, but parity, they have the best players. I mean, maybe I think Johnny's right. Iowa State probably has that next group, or they could realistically challenge Kansas for the top, like, you know, collection of talent, but I still think Kansas has the best. You know, we'll see. They play Kansas State here tonight, right? I want to say so. Be interesting to see how that comes out, but I mean, traditionally we've seen this before, like not quite at this level, but Kansas has had times in the past where, oh well, if Kansas loses this game, then maybe so, and they find a way to get it done. So
sort of like, you don't bet against Tom Brady, you don't bet against Kansas.
and I just think that they have enough guys on the perimeter that can get things done. I wouldn't be surprised to see Grimes play better as the year goes on, stuff like that. And honestly, like, it's not really surprising to me that they've had this difficult stretch as they're trying to figure out mid-season how to play without Azubuike. So that takes a while. So I wouldn't be shocked if they can kind of pick it up a little bit.
And I think, to Tim's point, if Grimes gets going and plays the way that a lot of people, including myself, thought he would this year, then yeah, Kansas is likely to, you know, make that one game separation they need to win outright. If he doesn't, then I think the tie's more likely, personally.
Mm-hmm. that kind of brings up the question, because when I'm looking through Kansas' schedule right now, they have already played the top team in the Big 12, which is Iowa State right now at 7-3 as we record this. They have Kansas State two times. Kansas State number two alongside Baylor, who's also 6-2, who they're playing again at the end of the season. Also, they had to play Tech. Really, there's one game that I know for sure is going to be a difficult game at Texas Tech. The Tech crowd will get up for that game because it's a night game in Lubbock. There's nothing else to do there. What can we expect out of Kansas State and Baylor? Are those two teams legit this year?
So, okay, let me split this to each of them. For me, Kansas State's next four games are going to determine their season because they have Kansas, at Baylor, at Texas, and then Iowa State. And they still have, so they've still got two games left against Baylor. They still got two games left against Kansas. So Kansas State, even though their record has been good thus far, it is their schedule is still a bit backloaded. So that's one of the reasons I see them kind of falling off a little bit. As for Baylor, Baylor still has to go to Tech. They still have to play. Actually, I think they have to play at Tech. They have to play at Iowa State. They have to play at Kansas. They have to play at Kansas State. So, I mean, if I'm picking like the four hardest games on anyone's schedule, those are them. Maybe not Kansas State, but the other three, all of those are difficult places to play. So, that, and I don't know if what they're doing is sustainable because they've had to go ultra small because of the injuries they've had, which means they've got a number of shooters on the floor, but it also means that there's times when they don't have a guy above 6'7" on the court. And, you know, against some teams that may not matter, but against like Texas, they better be able to cut off the outlet passes to Osakowski or to keep the guard from lobbing the ball to Hayes, because they're not going to be able to stay with those guys vertically. So I feel like Baylor's, I feel like they're being streaky, and I'm still not entirely convinced, even though admittedly their last two wins have been very impressive, but they've also been white hot from three of those two games. And so I just don't know how much of it is replicable.
I guess I'm prepared to give Kansas State the opposite Kansas treatment. It certainly feels like if you can kind of bank on the Jayhawks coming through in tough games, that's the opposite of how I feel about a Bruce Weber team. Yeah. I kind of get the impression that, yeah, they've shown us a lot of times before they can't really sustain greatness. But, you know, on a given night, it would not surprise me to see either Barry Brown or Dean Wade be the best player in the Big 12. I mean they are capable of having those kind of nights, so we'll see. Baylor, I'm interested to see how that kind of fits. They've, you know, they won at Oklahoma State. I want to say they maybe won at West Virginia, so they've already kind of taken care of a little bit of that. So, you know, some of those iffy games they've taken care of, whereas Texas obviously lost at Oklahoma State. Like Johnny, also, I don't know if they can sustain shooting 43% from three, you know, for multiple games. I want to say they're first in the conference right now in 3-point percentage.
Yeah, they're like almost 41%.
Yeah, that's really, really high. That's super, super high. If you have two or three guys shooting that on your team, then you probably would feel great about it. To have your entire team shoot that is kind of nuts. So I'm not prepared to chalk that up and say, well, this is who they are. So we'll see as time kind of goes on. Sometimes you see a team lose some players in the middle of the season and it hurts them. Sometimes you see a team lose some players and then it takes the opposition a little bit longer to kind of get some footage on there. Okay, well, here's how we're going to defend them. So that will be interesting to place. But those two teams are, yeah, those two teams, for as good as they're sitting right now, if we fast forward five games, are they closer to 500 than they are, 10-3 or whatever it would be? We'll see. But yeah. I think they've got a lot of questions to answer, even as well as they've played through this part of the conference slate.
So
since we're talking about sort of the middle of the bracket, and especially Baylor and Kansas State, two teams who you're both saying could make big jumps up and down the standings or stay where they are, what other teams will be making those big jumps up and down the standings? Who are you expecting to maybe have a complete turnaround or tank the rest of the season?
Well, biggest mover, that's tough. I guess I actually think that I'm a little bit surprised at some of the teams that have the positive records they do. I really thought that it would be Kansas and then everybody else this year, that everyone else would be mired in that, you know, right around 500 or a game or two below, up or down. And maybe that'll pan out as the rest of the season continues. I am not the believer in Iowa State that some other people are. I just think that they, even as they beat Oklahoma on the road, I don't think that they can sustain that, or at least they haven't been able to sustain that over the last handful of years of, yeah, we're going to be that team. I think that that they're gonna lose some tough games on the road down the stretch, and they're not invulnerable at home, as we saw from our game against them, I guess, if you come out with a great game plan. I don't think Tech is – so I guess for me, I don't think any number of these teams are going to be all that great on the positive side. I don't think Tech is going to run away with anything. I don't think Kansas State or Baylor is going to run away with anything. I don't think that – I wouldn't be surprised if Iowa State drops, you know, a couple games in a row here or there, maybe multiple times the rest of the season. I think it's going to revert to more chaos as far as everyone's kind of beating everybody. More so than, oh, this one specific team is looking at a precipitous fall.
Yeah, I think for the most part, I agree with Tim. There are a couple of exceptions. When I was looking at Oklahoma's schedule earlier today, they were 3-6. They're now 3-7 because they lost to Iowa State. Their next three games are home against Tech, at Baylor, at TCU. So there's a really good chance that they could be 3-10 in conference when they come to Texas. And that's
when we go there.
Or yes, I'm sorry, you're right. Yeah, when Texas comes to Norman. So there's a really good chance that they will be full on reeling for the second year in a row. And I don't know how those players react to, I don't know if I'd say the third, just because the third was basically terrible the whole time, right? Like they were,
yeah, okay. Yeah. Like, they were trash the same year we were trash. Yeah.
I'm speaking more to how, you know, last year with Trae Young, they got really high up and then they just fell off the map. And
sure,
they didn't quite get that, you know, they didn't get that high this year, obviously, but they were ranked and, you know, people were starting to look at them as a maybe 4, 5, 6 seed kind of thing. And, you know, they may be in another season of, season ending, falling off the cliff. And I don't know how they solve that. They look right now more like I thought they would look at the beginning of the season than I thought they would look at after looking at the end of the non-conference play, when they looked a lot better. So
plus they're veteran led. I mean, they have a lot of like veteran guys. It's not as if they have a bunch of freshmen who are still figuring stuff out. Like,
right.
They have guys that shouldn't be falling to this kind of struggles.
Yeah, I mean, they're the 34th most experienced team in D1, according to Pomeroy. So on the flip side, I look at TCU's schedule, and they're 3-5 right now. So they still have 10 games left to play, as opposed to most of the teams have at 8 or 9. They've already played some of their harder games on the schedule. Like, they've already gone to Kansas. They've gone to Kansas State. They've gone to Tech. They've gone to Baylor. So they're sort of home heavy the rest of the way. I just look at their schedule and it feels like if they could kind of, you know, keep their mind right, they could put together a couple little strings here where they win 2 or 3 games in a row and they go from being 3-5 to maybe like, you know, 8-6 or 8-7 or something, and then they got a couple games left to play, or maybe like 9-8 with a game left or something like that. So it's not like I think they're going to contend for the conference crown, but I feel like they might be, you know, they might be able to make some noise upward.
They have so little depth though. Yeah, they're, I mean, it's gonna have to go really right for them.
True.
So yeah,
Yeah, I think they're, I mean, they don't have much depth. Tech doesn't have a lot of, or Tech has a lot of depth, but they don't tend to play a lot of guys. Like, their top three guys play a ton of minutes.
Well,
and so they might deal with some, fatigue issues. I think Tim's right in that there's probably going to be a lot of teams in that sort of 9-9, 10-8-ish range, give or take. There's probably going to be a lot of chaos, and there's probably going to be a number of what the fuck losses and what the fuck wins by a variety of teams as the season goes on.
Before we get into Texas, though, I want to ask y'all last question about Big 12 in general. Who's the last place team? Who is the team that's going to be finishing the very bottom of the chart?
So as much as West Virginia looked like a D3 team against Texas Tech tonight, I still think it's going to be Oklahoma State. I think they're both going to be battling for the bottom, but Oklahoma State just seems like they're not, I don't know, the pieces don't quite fit, and unless they're just shooting lights out from three, they're extremely beatable. And West Virginia still goes after rebounds and still, you know, they still play hard, even if they play kind of dumb at times. So I'm going to say Oklahoma State is last in the conference.
Yeah, I believe that any of Oklahoma, Oklahoma State, and West Virginia can be the worst team on any given night. They are all three capable of some pretty shitty performances. I would have thought it was going to be Baylor, West Virginia, and Oklahoma State a month ago. Baylor's turned it on. We'll see if they can sustain that. I doubt it, but maybe so. Yeah, my guess is that I think that West Virginia is going to be the team that ends up losing it. I don't think they can sustain their energy and effort. I just think Huggins is going to wear on that team too much.
So he might already have.
Yeah, so that's got to be a very, very tough place to play. A very tough coach to play for when things are going poorly. So
Huggins is an angry fat man.
he's a guy that is really, when things are going well, he's very testy and difficult to be around. When things are going not well, I can't fathom it, you know. So
he's a more lovable Bob Knight.
But only slightly so.
Let's go ahead and focus on the team who we all cover, the Longhorns. What should Texas fans expect out of Longhorns for the second half of the conference schedule?
I think they're going to get enough wins to be solidly in the discussion to go to the tournament. Similar. Who were you talking about?
How many wins is that?
Well, I just really think that so many of their analytics are going to be in their favor, right? A terrific strength of schedule. I think they're something like fifth overall right now or whatever it is as far as nationally for their strength of schedule. There's not a bad loss looming on their, on our radar. Like, I mean, I guess Oklahoma State at home would be a truly...
Georgia.
Yeah, but that's done, and our numbers aren't looking that bad. You know what I mean? Like, yes, you're right. But
oh, I see. It going forward.
Yeah. If we lost at home to Oklahoma State, that'd be a bad loss. But Kansas lost at West Virginia. So from that standpoint, I don't know. I would imagine that Texas is going to be squarely in that mix of anywhere between what, like 3 and 5 teams that are all somewhere between 8 and 10 and 10 and 8. And if one of those teams hops up to 11 wins, then they're going to get that separation and they'll be the 2 seed or they'll be the 3 seed. And the rest of us will kind of be mired in that kind of maelstrom in the center. So, yeah, if any of us are hoping for some kind of like, okay, now we're going to figure out our consistency. Okay, now Texas is going to finally understand where they're at. Great. I mean, one thing that will be interesting, because I was thinking about this earlier today in the car as I was driving around. This is the first year that Shaka has not had to replace either his best or second best player outright. Right? So I think Ridley was probably pretty clearly at least the second best player for Texas in Shaka's first year. He goes down, I want to say, late December.
Yeah.
Mac, who was the leading scorer for Texas in that second year. I think Allen was their best player, but Mac was probably their second best player. All of a sudden, in the early conference season, he's gone. Andrew Jones, late December. I think Andrew played at least one or two games in conference. Like, I know he played at Kansas, I want to say. So this is the first time that Shaka has not had to replace an absolute key component to his team. So,
mid-season.
Yeah, mid-season, right? So from that standpoint, like, as inconsistent as we've obviously been, there is some, like, there is a little bit of, like, a rock or a foundation that we haven't had before in Shaka's tenure here. So I'll be interested to see if there's any type of hey, do we kind of figure out how we can, manufacture some consistency? But if we're hoping for that, I just don't think it's – I don't think that's likely to happen.
So I'm going to be in the unusual position of being the optimist here.
Johnny.
Yeah, I'm really this makes me very uncomfortable. I feel very vulnerable and open and exposed, and this is not.
He's sweating profusely, folks.
Yeah, so
Johnny, why are you shaking?
Yeah, don't look at me. I'm shutting the camera off. So here's the problem: is that that's how I start the optimistic part, is me talking about the problem.
You see the issues, this folks.
Yeah, I got to be optimistic, but in my way. So the problem
is pessimism.
Yeah.
For everybody else.
Yes. The problem is that Tim is exactly right in that expecting consistency is folly, because they'll be consistent in one aspect and then consistent in another aspect, but never at the same time. And so you get these sort of varying results. And so it's entirely possible that Texas ends up like 7-11, 8-10 in conference. Having said that, I looked at the schedule today, and based off of what I think of this team and sort of what I would call their median performance, because it goes up and down, but we'll just call it sort of middle of the road performance, where the kind of game I think that Tim and I would consider a replicable game, and sort of the schedule that's left, their away games are West Virginia, which is not going to be the same as other West Virginia years, at Oklahoma, which is, it's a rivalry game, so they'll be somewhat pumped. But again, like I was talking about, they may be on the middle of a 4 or 5 game losing skid at that point. At Baylor, which should be tough. At Tech, which will be tough. But the other games are all at home. Like, they play Baylor. They play Baylor this week. They play K-State at home. They play Oklahoma State at home. They play Iowa State at home. They play TCU at home. Like, it's not hard for me to imagine them going 6-3 out of those 9 games. And if they do, that's 10-8. And if they're 10-8...
Assuming consistency.
Well, let me put it this way. If I think their inconsistency will be as consistent as it has been, then I think they could pull off 6 wins there. Because at one, like I said, most of those games are at home, and they have played better at home in the conference play than they have on the road. Considerably better at home on average than on the road. Plus the stretch of Kansas at home and at Iowa State, even though they're 1-1 out of those, the performance level in both of them was at 2 consistent games. Their level of play was consistent enough that they could beat the number one team in the conference at home, and they got within a possession of Iowa State on the road with, what was it, about a minute left, or give or take, or 30 seconds left, something like that.
Inside of a minute, I think, yeah.
Yeah, so they, I hope they are figuring it out. I'm not going to predict they'll figure it out, but it's fairly plausible. I'm not going to say easy, because nothing with this team is easy, but it is fairly plausible to see them going 5-4, 6-3 out of their last 9, and then they're 9-9 or 10-8, and either of those, they get in fairly comfortably. Because, like, if you look at what Tim was talking about, sort of the analytics, plus the fact that the at-large bids are pretty shitty this year. Like, the Pac-12 alone is probably opening up 2 or 3 spots that would have been taken in another year. And like, you know, you look at Lunardi's bracketology, and even before they beat Kansas, he still didn't have them as their last four in or last four byes. Like, Texas was still comfortably in even before the Kansas win. So there are plenty of that Oklahoma State at home would be a bad loss, but there are no other potentially bad losses out there in terms of RPI or net. But there's a lot of resume building opportunities there. So
maybe TCU at home.
Yeah. It would be, you know, they could do that. That would be the last game of the season or the regular season. So that would be, you know, nice to end on. I mean, like the way I sort of,
as a loss, it would not be a nice way to end on.
Oh, that would be a bad loss. Sorry. I thought you were saying as a win. Sorry. Yeah. I mean, I could see them going on a run here. Of course, I could see them going on a run earlier in the season. It didn't work out. So, you know, I may be completely off here, but I feel like 5-4, 6-3 is a pretty plausible path forward, with obviously like the games at Baylor and Tech and Iowa State at home being the most likely losses out of the group that they've got left.
And that puts you sort of where we expected Texas at the beginning of the year, which was like 8-10 wins in conference, somewhere in that range, except for you have losses against Radford, VCU, Providence, and Georgia that you weren't expecting, but you also had a win against UNC that you weren't expecting. So,
and the Purdue win looks better and better as time goes on, because Purdue is lighting up the Big Ten right now.
So there's some differences, there's some give and take there, but what are you guys expecting as the biggest speed bumps for Texas going into the second part? What is going to be the game that's going to give Texas some trouble after we've seen basically each one of these teams at least once, except for Baylor? Which is going to be the game where you're expecting, hey, Texas has a chance here, but there's a big speed bump?
I mean, I think the game at Tech is the hardest game remaining on their schedule, probably by a fairly large amount. They're done with
that's
Kansas.
Like that's like a pothole, not even a pot. That's like a sinkhole in the middle of the road right there.
Yeah, it's
more than a speed
bump. Yeah, I mean, I would put that one sort of where I put the game against Iowa State going into it, where it's like, I think the prudent thing is to expect a loss and hope for a competitive game and see if they can pull it out. Because I mean, Tech is not a world beater, but they are very good at home and they have a very good defense. And you know, it'll be interesting. It's not an unwinnable game, but it's not an easily winnable game either.
Home to Baylor, home to OSU, at West Virginia. This year has been littered with the up and down, and it felt like if we could have. So when Texas has been at their best on the road, like at Kansas, at Iowa State, like if we had come with those types of games at Oklahoma State, like if we'd played like either of those games at OSU, I think we win.
Oh, easily, yeah.
Yeah. If we had played, so there's pockets of that, but there's also like, are we going to show up, you know, and we've, our lows this year have been so low that it's tough for me to overlook kind of anything. And if this is going to devolve, like if this were to devolve, as Will says, you know, into some kind of like, oh, well, this speed bump is too much for us to get over. Those would be the games that I think are most scary to me, because we can absorb a loss at pretty much any other game, right? If we lose to Iowa State at home, sucks. That, you know, that was a chance to kind of build our resume, but you know, it's not going to drop our RPI or drop some of those analytical pieces too far. If we don't win at Tech, okay, right? Like they, no one's going to knock us for that. But this team has proven that they can't win. Now, and on the flip side, if we win those three games, if we beat Baylor at home, if we beat Oklahoma State at home, if we win at West Virginia, if we can go 3-0 over those games, I really feel comfortable enough to say we're going to steal two or three more wins with the rest of our schedule that will make that 10-8 mark. So, but those three games need to be wins.
Yeah, that's, I think Tim is absolutely onto something, that it's not the big games that Texas has trouble getting up for. It's the ones that they feel like they should be favored. Those have been the ones where they've put in the clunkers, like the at Oklahoma State, they took them too lightly. They, you know, didn't come out with the energy they thought they should at TCU, although I don't know why they would consider themselves favored there, but I think, or Radford and VCU. I think Tim is right. Like those, those are probably a better barometer of where this team is than the big games, because that would be a sign of progression, a sign of showing consistent effort at every game that they haven't done yet.
So let's go ahead and I'll end off Texas there, and let's go ahead and talk about the reality of the Texas players now. So at the beginning of the season, we talked about what we expected out of each one of these players. What are they now? Here's how we're kind of going to go through it. Tim and Johnny each taking about three players, and I'll take two of the guys who actually play. Sorry, Royce Ham fans.
Fan.
And we're going to go ahead and talk about what they are now. What do we expect, and what are they? And what they're going to be for the rest of the season. So we'll start off with you, Johnny. Let's talk about the guy who everybody hyped up last year. People were expecting him to be a contributor, or at least a leader, but kind of hasn't been that. Dylan Osakowski, what do we expect out of him? What have we gotten?
I think the reality for him now is you get to take 1 to 2 threes a game unless they are just wide fucking open. Otherwise, we are going to get you either pump faking and then backing down into the paint, or getting into the paint first and getting an entry pass and trying to do something close to the basket, and go get rebounds. Those are your things. Like, you're the best rebounder on the team. Go get rebounds. We will try and get you touches as close to the paint as possible.
The next guy we have is Jace Fabris. And Tim, what do you think of Jace Fabris? What were you expecting coming into the season? What did we get?
He gave us glimpses as we got into conference season of dribble penetrating a little bit more. I think teams have done a good job of taking that away from him. Was it the TCU game, I think, that they – or Georgia, for sure, too. Georgia was face-guarding him, like, no matter where he was. There was a Georgia guy that had his back to the action regardless, and they were very close to Jace, kind of trailing him the whole time. He's proven that he's a good enough shooter that he can get hot pretty much whenever. If a team is playing us playing him a little bit more honestly and giving him some space, he could dribble penetrate. But I do think a lot of his efficiency and his production is going to come from, can we manufacture open looks for him? Because he's not a guy that's going to, I had hoped that maybe he'd be a guy who could a little bit bring some stuff off the bounce of, you know, can he pull up from three? That's happened a couple times, but that's just not a wrinkle in his game just yet. He's not a guy that we're bringing off of curls to shoot shots. We've only done that like two or three times. So he still is a guy that if we can manufacture some open looks for him where either on like dribble penetration and kickouts or on, you know, some slips or reversals, okay, I like that they've incorporated some more of him like being a screener, but he's still kind of a catch and shoot guy pretty predominantly.
And with Texas's lack of depth, he's kind of become a big man as well, kind of playing a power forward role that we weren't expecting going into the season. And also taking a lot more drives to the basket than we were expecting.
Yeah, he did for a while there. He hasn't as much the last few games. Defensively, he's been okay. He still has his lapses. He was off the floor almost the entire end of the game against Iowa State because defensively he just was struggling finding shooters. He had had some pockets early in the season where he rebounded well. He's done that some. So, you know, there's enough to feel good about the future. But as far as right now, I think that it's kind of more situational. And you know, if we have games where we feel like we can create some shots for him, good. But otherwise, he's not ready to take over games with the ball in his hands.
The next guy we're going to be talking about is Courtney Ramey, my guy. We came into the year expecting him, well, at least Johnny expected him to be the fifth starter. I don't know if Tim did. Tim, did you?
I thought, yes, a little bit. No, I wasn't as number one with a bullet as Johnny was. He called that earlier than I did, but yeah. I thought it was possible.
Good call, Johnny. So we are expecting him to be sort of the Matt Coleman backup, or at least a guy who handles the ball a little bit, but Matt Coleman is the main ball handler. Courtney Ramey has been asked to be the primary ball handler in the past few games and has done okay with it. His shooting beyond the arc is good. Like, Courtney Ramey beyond the arc is a really good player, and that's where they're going to ask him to play going forward because his versatility inside the arc is not great. He doesn't get to the rim off of a drive. I mean, I don't remember the last time he drove to the rim. It might have been TCU, right? And he's been very turnover prone inside the arc as well, when he tries to get in there. He's done well with a few cuts to the basket off of off-ball movement, but getting himself in there and getting the ball out to kickouts and all the things he needs to do in this offense, he's not been great. So him playing outside the arc is probably where we'll be seeing him going forward, especially taking threes. I mean, he's been red hot from 3-point land. So that's exactly where I think the reality of him is going forward.
He has been about as advertised or a little bit better than advertised defensively too, which is good. I mean, they're entrusting him with some pretty tough assignments defensively. So that obviously speaks to what Shaka believes as far as his ceiling as a defender, even as a freshman. But yeah, offensively, I think you're right. He's either a 3-point shooter or a guy who tries to penetrate with the idea of like, I'm going to kick out. It's not to go finish at the rim.
Right. So the next guy we have is Jericho Sims for Johnny. Johnny, what were you expecting out of Jericho Sims? I mean, we were expecting a lot more. And what is he now?
I was expecting him to be what Jackson Hayes has been this year. That's basically what I was hoping/expecting. This is going to be the first in a series of guys who my answer is, you get 2 minutes to show me something or get the fuck out. it's not quite that bad, but with Sims, he's shown some signs of life lately, but he is definitely going to be the backup who is there to spell Hayes, whether it be for fatigue or foul trouble reasons. Go get some rebounds, try and get a putback here and there if you can. Don't dribble more than 3 times. And
that's your free throws?
Yeah, that's, I mean, yes, kind of. It doesn't seem like it should work, but it's working, so great. Keep going. But that's Sims at this point. And hopefully next year he can be more of this than he was this year. But I mean, to his credit, he hasn't given up. He hasn't sulked. He hasn't taken his demotion poorly. He's invested and he's working on it, and he's providing some minutes that he was not a couple of months ago.
And Tim, your boy, Matt Coleman, what were you expecting? What's the reality?
This is a tough one for me to kind of come to grips with, because I've been so surprised at the discrepancy in his usage. Earlier in the season, it felt like we gave the ball to Roach a lot, and Kerwin had an opportunity to kind of be a playmaker and creator, and then Kerwin struggled. So we gave the ball back to Matt, and then he kind of steadied the ship a little bit, but now we're seeing, as you said, well, a lot of times, like, that initial ball handler for us in our half-court sets has been Ramey. And that's, like, and I don't mind that. I think Matt's a little bit steadier with the ball than Courtney is, but I can see how they're doing that. But it sure just simply looks like, hey, Matt, just so you know, like, we're going to go ahead and have someone else be our primary ball handler than you right now, right? So, like, he's going to be counted on to sort of be that, okay, how is Roach doing this game? How is Ramey doing this game? Depending on that, all right, Matt, then we'll figure out what the fuck you're doing. Is he going to be a scorer? Is he going to be a facilitator? I think that sort of his role from game to game, the reality of it right now is it's up in the air. Like, you don't really know from one game to the next, is he going to be really a primary focus, or is he going to be, you know, someone who takes 2 or 3 shots in an entire game? Like, one game, 2 or 3 shots, the next game, 13. So that just looks kind of like such is Matt Coleman right now, which I'm a little disappointed with for him. I can imagine he might, if he was not such an unselfish player and kind of unselfish person, maybe he'd be feeling the same stuff. I can't speak to his exact mindset right now, but it sure looks like his reality is, let's see what Roach and Ramey do in a specific game. Matt, then we'll kind of dictate your role depending on that. And defensively, tremendous. Like, he's done a really good job. A lot of times he's taking the toughest assignment every game. Him and Ramey are switching on that a decent amount. So you can kind of check with Roach sometimes to see if he's engaged with that. And if he is, awesome. But a lot of times it's Matt on the toughest player for the opponent.
And Jackson Hayes is the next guy we're going to get into. And I get him. Jackson Hayes, because he's easy. Jackson Hayes, we weren't expecting much out of Jackson Hayes. Well, we were expecting sort of he's in there to supplement the time we need Jericho Sims out. And because it seemed like he was a guy who had the athleticism for the next level, but didn't have the mental capabilities yet for the next level. He has proven himself to be much better than anything we were expecting. He has proven that his hands can translate to the next level. He has proven that he can play with some of the big men down low. He has proven he can be an offensive weapon and he can be a defensive weapon up on the boards. He still has some places where he needs to get better, such as, you know, the fouls. He's been easily players have been able to get fouls drawn in him quite easily. I mean, just take a look at the Kansas game, 3 fouls in less than a minute. And things like his ability to back down a player, he's never going to be able to do that. He's more of a guy who's going to turn around and jump shot rather than back down a player or at least make a cut to the bucket for a pass or a layup. So that's what you're going to expect out of him is more of the same, really, what you've been getting out of Jackson Hayes. Just a guy who has become an explosive offensive player, a guy who can get you the blocks you need on the other side of the glass, on the other side of the court, and a guy who is just pretty solid, but not anything that's going to be like game-breaking at this level. Not yet, at least. So the next guy we have, is a guy who should be game-breaking in Curran Roach. Tim, what do you think of Curran Roach so far, and what's the reality going forward?
Well, I think that he's got the longest leash of anybody. We've talked a lot this year about how far his shot percentages drop when he shoots off the bounce, either in the mid-range or from the three-point line, and we saw that again against Iowa State there on the road. I think he took 3 or 4 shots off the dribble. As far as jump shots, he missed all of them. And yet he doesn't sit for it, right? I mean, so Shaka is obviously saying to him, look, you know, even if you're not taking our highest percentage shots, like, you're going to keep on getting minutes. So I think that kind of, I don't want to say he runs the show. He doesn't necessarily, but I do think that he has a lot of leeway. He has a decent amount of leash that he can kind of work with. I think it's pretty telling to me that he is just as likely on the third best perimeter player for the opponent as he is the best, which is obviously tells me that Shaka has as much faith in his other two perimeter defenders as he does with Kerwin. So, you know, I don't expect that to change. I don't think all of a sudden we're going to see Roach come in with a game and all, you know, be at like 10 or 12 minutes short of some kind of foul trouble, which is not unthinkable, but I doubt it. But he's gonna get a lot of minutes. He's gonna have a chance to play aggressively offensively, and I guess depending on the night, maybe we'll ask for him to do some good defensive work or against the better players, or you know, as much of the time we'll see if he can kind of just be solid and do what he can. So
I know Johnny has something to say about this. What do you think, Johnny?
I would like for Tim to take as a personal homemaking project to visualize the difference in size of the leash Roach gets from Shaka from what he would have gotten if Barnes was still here.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we'd all be seeing probably... Well, I mean,
we would be seeing Curwin Roach at, like, San Diego State or something.
Yeah, 38 minutes of Ramey, 39 minutes of Coleman, like one game 25 minutes of Febres, the next half a minute or something like that. Yeah, it's interesting, and I've been, I mean, you'll speak to it soon enough here, Johnny. Like, I do think that this, I'm surprised at Eli's and Kamaka's Hepa minutes right now. I'm surprised that you know, that Shaka has kind of been as cold-blooded as he has with some of these minute allotments, but we're not even close to Barnes territory at this point.
So, Johnny, talk to me about Kamaka Hepa and Muchulong. Like, you can add the two together because both of them have sort of played similar amount of minutes in terms of their roles. go ahead and lump those two together. What are we talking about? Start with Hypa.
So with Kamaka Hypa, I feel it's probably more of a look, if Osakowski gets in foul trouble super early, then we might bring you in. But otherwise, I feel like Hepa's lack of minutes is not entirely his fault as so much as it is Osakowski being clearly the best rebounder on the team, and they need him out there getting rebounds because Hayes, he's getting a little better at it, but he's not a great rebounder. You know, you can't have Sims out there at the same time as Hayes, really, because that presents a lot of other problems. So, like, there's just not very good rebounding on this team outside of Osakowski, at least not reliably. And so if Dio can't sit, then where are you putting Hypa? Because you can't really put those two out there together because it creates log jams elsewhere. It's just complicated. So Hypa, I feel like he's... If he gets minutes in a game, it is, let's see how well you shoot. Because if Hypa is hitting from three, they can find the rebounds elsewhere that they need. Otherwise, he's probably not out there much this year. Which kind of sucks because there are things he does I like. He's obviously very communicative on defense. He's very aware of what's going on around him. So like there are signs that make me very optimistic about next year. It's just this year, the reality is you get to swing a towel around a lot and occasionally come in if there's some foul trouble. Yeah, do the three arrow. That's right. Eli Long, it is... we're going to send you out there for 2 to 3 minutes, and if you go full Eli, we're bringing you right the fuck back out of this game.
You because, never go full Eli.
Yeah, don't go full Eli. We need 85% Eli. Like, this is not the And One mixtape tour. You are not hot sauce. Do not try and pull that bullshit here, because you're going to end up with like a Texas Tech defender taking the ball the other direction.
I like some of that stuff. Like, he makes some creative passes.
If they work, great. But here's the thing. He's not good enough to get away with that shit.
Like, I think it's more that the rest of the team hasn't played enough with him to really expect it. Because a lot of the passes kind of catch people by surprise. They're like good passes, but they just nobody's expecting them.
There is a little to that, because guys who have that sort of creative flair, their teammates have to work extra hard to understand when that stuff is likely to happen. Like when Jakovin was here, his first year, there were a number of times when there was some really impressive pass that was a turnover because, you know, that guy was not expecting that right at his face, right at that moment, you know. Yeah,
hit and Clint Chapman right in his nose.
Yeah, that kind of thing. There is something to that. But the other thing is that, you know, at the beginning of the season, I thought, okay, Eli has basically been recruited over. I understand why they took him at the time they did because of their lack of guard depth. But they also, at the time, were not expecting Courtney Ramey to be here. Yeah. I didn't think he was going to get many minutes. And early in the season, it looked like I was going to be wrong about that because they were giving him starters minutes for the most part. But as non-conference play wound down and conference play kicked in, those numbers flipped because Courtney Ramey took over a lot of those minutes, and deservedly so. So I don't know if he can grad transfer after a transfer, but because he didn't graduate from Mount St. Mary's, so that was just a normal transfer. So he could grad transfer, I guess.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, I shouldn't really talk about attrition, but maybe that's where he ends up, because I don't see where the minutes are coming for him down the line.
He's just so guardable. I mean, for a guy who is supposed to be creative and like can score with the ball in his hands and facilitate and like do all these things, like I don't think we've seen a team help off onto him in the last 10 games. Like no one is helping off on him. They like almost every Big 12 team can handle him one-on-one defensively, and if he can't find that space to work in because no one is having no one has to like play his ball handling honestly, then like you can't, he's not going to pass someone open. Like he can come up with some creative passes if he's got an angle, but he's not going to pass them open. He's not going to create that opening with his dribble penetration, or at least he hasn't been able to lately. Like his go-to shot is end of the shot clock, heave three-pointer, right? And
that goes off the top of the backboard.
Yeah. So
it sucks because, like, you know, he seems like a legitimately likable dude, and you know, he's really invested in the team and whatnot, and you know, he works hard at his game. He's just, you know, he is not good enough to crack the starting rotation for this team.
Yeah,
I think that's a good place to end it off. So let's go ahead and do that. Thank y'all for pretending we were football for the past hour or so. I have been your host, Will Baizer. You guys can find me on Twitter at WillBaizer. And Johnny Brashear, where can we find you, man?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Discord at BitterWhiteGuy. And I'm also at Barking Carnival, telling certain commenters to gargle my balls.
You know who you are.
And Johnny, you know what's coming up, don't you?
What's that?
Tim, you know what's coming up?
Sure.
Johnny, where in the world is Timothy Preston?
1, 2, 3, yeah!
He's in Iowa.
It's gotten cold again here. It was like 45 degrees on Saturday and Sunday.
That was palpable disappointment from Tim.
Yep, and it was like 22 degrees again today. Very cold. Bitter cold, as AccuWeather.com would describe it. Bitter cold.
Bitter white guy. Am I right? So, Tim, where else can we find you other than the state of Iowa?
Yeah, InsideTexas.com. Great community there. Come hang out with us. And on Twitter, InsideTexasHoop. No S.
And, Tim, where can we find you on the basketball court?
Well, yeah, this week it'll be interesting because, you know, Texas has a game on Wednesday night. That's when I play at the Y, as you know. And
everybody knows, everybody should.
They should know. So, but provided I do get out there this week, I might take the week off at the YMCA just because of Texas playing Baylor, and I fucking hate Baylor, so hooray. But if I'm out there, I'm one of those guys you have to account for no matter where they're on the court. Like, if you're out behind the three-point line, hey, man, I excel out there, right? If I need to take it inside with the big boys, yeah, no problem. Like, I'm very, very comfortable down low. But as always, where I truly excel, where I'm at my very peak, is right in your fucking face.
You guys can find us and our other shows right here on the Hornscast Channel. It's the Hornscast Channel on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, Google Play, wherever you guys can find a podcast, you'll find the Hornscast. On that note, thank you for listening. We'll see y'all next week. Hook 'em.
Hook 'em horns.